ability to communicate is perhaps the most important single skill that you can develop in the pursuit of success and happiness. Fully 85% of your success in your personal life and in your work will come from your ability to communicate and interact effectively with other people. And there are a great number of things that you can do immediately to improve the quality of your communications. And you begin, of course, by going to work on yourself. All communication, all human interaction is from the inside out. You communicate what you are. And what you are is largely determined by your belief systems, by your self-concept. As I said before, you are not what you think you are, but what you think you are. There are two forms of communication, interpersonal and intrapersonal communication. Interpersonal communication includes all of your interactions with other people. Intrapersonal communications refers to your communications with yourself. How you get along with yourself, what's going on in your own mind, is the most important single determinant of your interpersonal communications, or how you get along with others. The law of expression says that whatever is impressed will be expressed. Your self-concept is the totality of your beliefs and ideas about yourself, formed as the result of every impression, experience, decision, choice, and action that you've taken or which has occurred in your life since you were an infant, and perhaps even before that. As an adult, you do not believe what you see, but rather you see what you believe. Put another way, what you see is what you are. Every event in the world around you, including and especially your human interactions, is colored and shaded by your own personality. The way you talk, walk, behave, listen to, and experience other people is determined more by your own mental programming than by any other factor. Your self-image, how you see yourself and think about yourself, is made up of three elements. There's the way that you see yourself, there's the way that others see you, and there's the way that you think that others see you. Your self-esteem is how much you like and respect yourself, how much you feel yourself to be a valuable and worthwhile person. When you experience high self-esteem, you tend to have a fully integrated self-image. That is, the way you see yourself, the way you think others see you, and the way that they actually do see you will all be the same. There will be no conflict or disagreement in your various images of yourself, and therefore there will be little conflict or disagreement between yourself and others. Another element of your intrapersonal communications is how good you feel you are at what you do. This is called self-efficacy, or performance-based self-esteem. When you like and respect yourself and you know you're good at what you do, you tend to enjoy a positive self-image that is immediately recognizable to other people. As you change and develop and improve internally, the quality of your relationships with others will improve automatically and effortlessly. For this reason, your ongoing inner dialogue of words and pictures will have more of an impact on the quality of your communications than any other factor. For example, the law of expectation says that whatever you expect with confidence tends to become your own self-fulfilling prophecy. Dr. Robert Rosenthal of Harvard demonstrated repeatedly that your expectations have a powerful impact on your outcomes. When teachers or parents expect young people to do well, they have a tendency to do far better than they would in the absence of those expectations. When friends or bosses or other people we respect tell us that they believe we are capable of doing certain things successfully, this confidence of theirs often overcomes our own personal skepticism about our abilities and causes us to do better than we would have. Similarly, your own expectations about yourself and your abilities have an enormous impact on how you behave and how people react to you. One of the most outwardly identifiable signs of a winning human being is an ongoing attitude of confident self-expectancy. This means expecting things to turn out well in advance. It means to continually look for the good in people and situations. If, whenever you meet a new person or enter into a new interpersonal situation, you confidently expect the other person to like you and you yourself expect to like the other person, the probability of both occurring goes up dramatically. If you expect to be successful, expect to be liked, expect to be popular, expect to be listened to, and expect to enjoy your relationship with others, you will seldom be disappointed. Positive affirmations can be very helpful in programming your mind for success with others. You can say things like, "I can hardly wait for this meeting," or, "I know everything is going to turn out well." When you repeat these affirmations to yourself with enthusiasm and conviction, your subconscious mind. Another exercise that you can use to improve your intrapersonal communications, the quality of your personality, and the messages you give yourself, is creative visualization. The way you see yourself as a person and in relationship to others, the inner mirror or mental picture that you carry around of yourself, is the key determinant of your performance and effectiveness with others. You can modify and improve your self-image and your effectiveness by repeatedly projecting on the screen of your mind a picture of yourself performing at your best. When you visualize and emotionalize an exciting picture of a successful event, real or imagined, your subconscious mind accepts this picture as a command, as operating instructions. It then goes to work to modify your levels of self-confidence, your enthusiasm, your body language, your tone of voice, and your facial expression. This kind of mental preparation, visualization, repeated over and over again, eventually locks in and becomes a natural and spontaneous part of your personality. You eventually develop the habit of a positive mental attitude. It's important to remember that everyone starts off in life with an inferiority complex. For the first few years of our lives, we see ourselves as small, defenseless, and vulnerable. If we've also been subjected to destructive criticism by our parents during these formative years, we will tend to grow up feeling that we are not as good as many other people. The fact is that most successful and popular men and women also grow up with feelings of inferiority. They overcame them as the result of long, hard work and by doing the things that we're talking about here. Your self-concept and your personality are not easily changed, but they can definitely be improved if you set it as a goal and go to work on it. When I was growing up, I was terribly unpopular. I spent much of my time as a child and as a teenager alone. I got into nothing but trouble in school, and neither teachers nor other students wanted to have anything to do with me. I was never invited to parties, and virtually no girl wanted to be seen with me. In an attempt to be liked, I seemed to do and say all the wrong things. I shot off my mouth in class, I interrupted with smart-aleck remarks, and I generally behaved in such a way that I ended up with very few friends. It took me many years of working on myself to first understand how my personality had developed this way, and second, to learn how to change. Perhaps the most important thing that happened to me was learning how to set goals and achieve them. As I developed a sense of my own worth based on accomplishment, I began to like and respect myself more, and pretty soon, other people began to like me as well. You can develop a positive, powerful, and pleasing personality that will enable you to get along with virtually anyone. You can enjoy all the success, happiness, and pleasure that comes from happy relationships with others in your work and in your personal life by setting it as a goal and working on yourself continually every single day. Now let's talk about interpersonal communication. Virtually everything that we get in life comes as a result of interacting effectively with one or more people. Skilled communicators rise to the top of every field and occupation. Your ability to get your point across in such a way that others want to help you to be successful is central to everything else you might want to achieve. Perhaps the best communication tool that you can develop is a positive mental attitude. The habit of keeping your conversation generally positive and optimistic will cause you to be liked and accepted in more places and by more people than any other single factor. A general attitude of cheerfulness arising from a positive self-image and a deep-down sense of your own value will surround you like a warm light and will trigger positive responses in everyone you meet. In study after study, the most effective and respected people are described with the word nice. When you're known and thought of as a generally nice person, all kinds of doors will open for you and people will be eager to help you and cooperate with you. In psychology, there is an expression used to describe this type of behavior. It is called unconditional positive regard. Psychologists and psychotherapists know that the key to helping their patients work through their problems is to create a relationship where the patient feels safe and secure. Only when a troubled person feels completely accepted can he or she verbalize and work through the problem that is bothering him or her. Unconditional positive regard means that you remain generally positive and supportive no matter what the other person says. If the other person is angry or upset, the psychotherapist responds with support and empathy. If the person is criticizing or condemning some other person or situation, the psychotherapist doesn't get caught up in the negative emotions. The psychotherapist merely nods and smiles pleasantly, allowing and encouraging the other person to fully vent their feelings. See yourself as a psychotherapist or as a good friend and practice unconditional positive regard with everyone. The primary reason that many people are such poor communicators is that their egos become so totally involved in the interaction that they become unaware of the other person. Many people are so concerned about themselves, about what they think, what they feel, about their own interests and concerns, that they merely use other people as sounding boards. They're not really interested in hearing or learning about the other person's situation. They're merely seeking an opportunity to express their own personal feelings and opinions. Fortunately, as you develop higher levels of self-esteem and self-acceptance, you become naturally less preoccupied with yourself and more interested in others. One way you can accelerate this development of a genuine interest in others is by acting the part, by pretending that you find the other person to be completely fascinating. A miraculous transformation occurs if you sincerely pretend to find another person interesting for any period of time. The other person will begin to open up to you and reveal to you facts about himself or herself that you will actually find fascinating. In less than 5 minutes of pretending interest in another person, you will be totally engrossed in what that person has to share with you. This is a real secret of excellent human relations. For example, a few years ago, because of an airline strike, I had to take a journey of 800 miles by bus, which meant leaving in the afternoon, traveling all through the night, and arriving in the middle of the next day. When I got on the bus, the only seat left was next to a young cowboy type who had obviously been drinking beer before he boarded. I was already disgruntled about the airline strike and having to take such a long bus ride, so my first impression of my fellow passenger was not particularly positive. However, since I was going to be sitting next to him for the next 16 hours, I forced myself to make the best of a bad situation. I pretended to be interested and asked him where he lived and where he was going. That began one of the most fascinating conversations I have ever had. It turned out that he had come to this city from a farm community in the Midwest for medical attention. He had personally built a one-man airplane from a kit that he had sent away for, and he used this airplane to fly all over the farm country where he lived. Basically, as I understood it, he sat under a wing with the propeller and the engine in the back. The reason he required medical attention was because he had crashed in a field while landing. Apparently, he had been caught in a downdraft that hurled him into the ground at 50 miles an hour. He had broken a leg and an arm, and I jokingly asked him what he was going to do with his time now that he'd given up flying. He laughed and assured me that he'd not given up flying at all, that while he was recuperating, he had rebuilt his plane, and as soon as he got back, he would be flying across the fields again. Experiences like that have convinced me that the life and work of virtually every person that you will ever meet will turn out to be fascinating if you give them an opportunity to tell you about it. When you get your ego out of the way and allow the other person's ego to express itself, you'll quickly find yourself becoming an excellent communicator. Let's talk now about the actual process of communicating. The president of a large company told me recently that 99% of the problems in his organization stem from poor or incomplete communication. In my consulting work with more than 300 corporations, I've never found a company in which the executives and staff did not feel that communications could be improved. This is probably true for most families and most relationships as well. It's easy to see why misunderstandings arise when we examine the actual process of communicating between just two people. Let us say that you want to communicate with another person. First, you conceive of the thought or idea that you wish to convey. Then, you translate or encode this thought into words. You then send the words in the form of a message. This message may be spoken face-to-face, by telephone, or in a written form. The receiver, or the person you are communicating with, then receives the message you have sent. The receiver must then decode or translate your message in order to get the meaning that you're trying to convey. The receiver then conceives of a reply in the form of a thought or idea, encodes the message in words, sends the message to you, and you in turn receive and decode that person's message. Even in the simplest of conversations, this is the process that takes place. What could be more simple? However, there are a lot of other factors that can enter into this act of communicating and cause possible distortion or misunderstanding of the message. We call these factors noise, like the noise or interference that you sometimes hear on a telephone line or when you're tuning into a radio station. There are several kinds of noise, physical as well as physiological. Physical noise refers to factors in the physical environment, such as cigarette smoke, radio or television, people walking past, traffic, children screaming, an airplane flying over, a car going past, or any other factor that might interfere with the clear reception of the message that you wish to convey. Any one of these distractions can cause your message to be misunderstood. Then, there's physiological noise. This refers to what is going on inside the person during the communication. The person may be suffering from fatigue or illness. The person may have a sore tooth or be preoccupied with some problem. The person may be angry or defensive about the message. The individual may also like or dislike you, either respect or not respect you, might find what you are saying interesting or not interesting. Imagine, for example, trying to communicate with someone who had a toothache, just had an argument with his or her boss, and was not particularly interested in the subject. Do you see how easy it would be for the communication to break down? As if the disturbing factors of physical and physiological noise were not enough, there are also the differences between verbal and nonverbal meanings in the message. Dr. Albert Mehrabian, a specialist in communications, has determined that only 7% of the message that we send is contained in the words themselves. Fully 38% of the message is contained in the tone of voice, and 55% of the message is contained in the body language and in the nonverbal gestures that accompany the message. We are very sensitive to verbal and nonverbal cues, and if the body language and tone of voice contradict the words, we tend not to believe the words. In a telephone conversation, the tone of voice becomes perhaps 85% of the message. Even a pause or hesitation becomes an important part of the communication when the only message is what you hear through the receiver on the phone. In addition to the interference from physical and physiological noise, plus the conflict between verbal and nonverbal cues, there's the whole issue of the meaning of words. Sometimes the right or wrong choice of words can have critical and far-reaching consequences. In the English language, there are more than 14,000 meanings for the 500 most common words that we use in our day-to-day lives. In addition, there are a total of 600,000 English words, some of which appear to be duplicated because they're spelled exactly the same way, but these words actually are completely different from one another because their meaning and pronunciation is different. Is it any wonder that there are so many misunderstandings between individuals and groups at every level of our society? It's been said that God gave us two ears and one mouth and that we should use them in the same proportions. We should listen twice as much as we speak. And herein lies the key to being a good communicator. In order to ensure that the message that you send is the message that is received, and the message that you receive is the message intended, you need to do two things. First, you need to accept 100% responsibility not only for being understood, but also for understanding. Stephen Covey recommends that you seek first to understand, then and only then to be understood. Most of us are so eager to get other people to understand us that we overlook or ignore the importance of understanding them. When you seek first to understand the other person, you're much more likely to communicate the right words in the right way and to create a desire in the other person to understand you as well. Second, to be a good communicator, you need to learn to be more sensitive not only to the words, but to the meanings that the other person attaches to the words. You need to be aware of both verbal and nonverbal messages. In short, you need to listen with your whole mind, to lean into the other person, to be sure that what you are hearing and what they are saying are the same thing. The very best communicators are not necessarily great talkers, but they are excellent listeners. It's been estimated that managers, executives, and leaders of all kinds spend as much as 50% of their time listening to other people. But most people are poor listeners, or what we might call non-listeners. They make the mistake of thinking that they are listening when, in reality, they are merely going through one or more exercises in non-listening. Because non-listening is the major reason for misunderstandings and breakdowns in communications, it's important for you to be aware of the various forms of non-listening so that you can check yourself to see if you are guilty of any of them. The first form of non-listening is called pseudo or phony listening. Pseudo-listening is an imitation of the real thing. The pseudo-listener gives the appearance of being attentive. He looks you in the eye, he nods and smiles at the right times, and he may even answer you occasionally. But behind that appearance of interest, something entirely different is going on. Pseudo-listeners use a polite facade to mask thoughts that have nothing to do with what the speaker is saying. Often, the pseudo-listener is ignoring you because something on his or her mind is more important to them than what you are saying. The pseudo-listener may simply be bored or think that he or she has already heard what you have to say before, so he tunes out your remarks. Whatever the reasons, pseudo-listening is really counterfeit communication. It is phony listening, and that soon becomes obvious to the other party. The second form of non-listening is called stage-hogging. The stage-hog is only interested in expressing his own ideas, and he doesn't care about what anyone else has to say. The stagehog will allow you to speak from time to time, but only so that he or she can catch their breath and use their remarks as a reason to go on babbling or to keep you from running away. Stagehogs don't really hold conversations. They are really making a speech and using the opportunity to dominate others with their talk. The third form of non-listening is called selective listening. Selective listeners respond only to the parts of your remarks that interest them, and they reject everything else. Unless you're talking about something that specifically interests them, they simply tune you out and think of other things. Selective listening is a form of selfish listening, wherein the listener is concerned only about himself or herself. Another form of non-listening is insulated listening. Insulated listeners simply avoid topics they would rather not talk about. They fail to hear or acknowledge them. If you remind them of a problem or bring something up that they don't want to deal with, they will nod and answer you and promptly ignore what you just said. Defensive listening is a form of non-listening in which the listener takes things that you intended as innocent comments and turns them into personal attacks. A person with a poor self-image or low self-esteem often reads into the most casual remarks a criticism or comment on their behavior and reacts defensively by striking back. This is especially true with hypersensitive men and women, those who've been subjected to a lot of destructive criticism during their formative years. Another form of non-listening is called ambushing. The typical ambusher is a person who listens to what you're saying, but he or she is seeking for an opportunity to attack you or disagree with you. The ambusher is always looking for differences between what you're saying and his or her point of view. When the ambusher picks up even a small piece of conflicting data in your conversation, he or she immediately uses it to counterattack in order to prove you wrong. The final form of non-listening is called insensitive listening. Insensitive listeners are those who make no effort to understand what the other person is really trying to say. They take the words of the other person at face value and make no effort to interpret the feelings behind the words. This kind of insensitivity, unfortunately, often occurs between men and women in relationships. Almost everyone is guilty of being a non-listener or a poor listener from time to time. If your goal is to become an excellent communicator, to be extremely effective in your interactions with other people, it's important for you to be aware of the reasons for the tendencies and temptations not to listen and pay full attention to people when they're speaking to you. One of the reasons why we don't listen as well as we could is because of message overload. You probably spend half of the time you're awake taking in verbal messages from bosses, friends, co-workers, family, salespeople, and others. You're bombarded with radio, television, and other commercial messages in the form of magazines and newspapers. Because of this message overload, you often tend to let your attention wander just to give yourself a break. Preoccupation is another reason why you don't always listen carefully. Often you get so wrapped up in your own personal concerns and problems that it's hard to pay attention to someone else. Instead, you go through the motions of pseudo-listening, nodding and smiling and pretending that you're paying attention when in reality your mind is miles away. Another reason for poor listening is the fact that there's a difference in the rate of speed between the number of words you can understand and the number of words that another person can speak. Your mind can understand speech at a rate of 600 words per minute, whereas the average person speaks at a rate of 125 to 150 words per minute. This means that you have fully three-quarters of the time that another person is speaking to think of other things. Your attention can wander onto other subjects while you still appear to be listening, and in fact, you are probably still taking in most of what the other person is saying. It takes tremendous self-discipline for you to control your attention and to concentrate on the various levels of meaning contained in the words that the other person is speaking. But the payoff in higher quality communications makes it worth the effort. Another reason why we don't listen well is the physical noise that I mentioned earlier. If you're tired or uncomfortable, or if the room is too hot or too cold, or if you're surrounded by noise of various kinds, it becomes very hard for you to concentrate on what the other person is saying. We often don't listen well because we feel that talking has more apparent advantages than listening. It seems to us that we have more to gain by speaking because it gives us a chance to control the thoughts and actions of the other person. Often, we feel that it gives us the chance to gain the admiration, respect, or liking of others. If we tell jokes or offer advice or tell them all we know about a particular subject, they will like us or be impressed by us. If we instead stand quietly and say very little, they may think that we have nothing worthwhile to say. Also, talking gives you a chance to release energy in a way that listening can't. We get a lot of pleasure out of expressing ourselves to others and talking about things that interest us or concern us personally. Unfortunately, it can get to the point where we fall in love with the sound of our own voice and go on talking without concern for the conversational needs of others. The final reason why we don't listen well is that we're not trained to do it. A common mistake is to think that listening is like breathing, that you do it naturally because you're alive. The truth is that listening is a skill very much like speaking. Although everybody does it, very few people do it well. Learning to listen well can do more to help your relationships and your career than perhaps any other single personality quality that you can develop. There's an old saying that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. The key to good listening is the friendship factor. The friendship factor is based on the fact that people want and need to be liked, and they will not allow themselves to be influenced by someone until they're convinced that that person is their friend. The friendship factor is built on the three C's: caring, courtesy, and consideration. The very best communicators tend to be sensitive to others and to project an attitude of genuinely caring about the thoughts, opinions, problems, and concerns of the other person. Each person needs to feel that he or she is valued by others, and the instant this connection takes place between two people, good communications begin to flow almost naturally. You can personally remember many experiences where you've met a person and had an instant feeling of rapport and friendliness. You were able to talk naturally and spontaneously for a long time on a variety of subjects without any tension or self-consciousness, and with a great deal of pleasure and satisfaction. Good communicators are those who are able to create this kind of communications experience with far more people, far faster, and more easily. This happens when you put aside your preoccupation with yourself and focus your attention outward onto the other person. There's a saying that everyone you meet is carrying a heavy load. Perhaps the best method of listening for building and maintaining high-quality relationships is empathetic listening, or listening to help. In this form of listening, you encourage people to talk about their problems and concerns, and then you help them to work their problems out for themselves. Often, what a person needs more than anything else is just a good sounding board, another person who will listen and, through proper responses, help the person come to his or her own conclusions. Much of modern psychotherapy is based on this idea that the patient is capable of his or her own healing if the proper helping or listening relationship is established. When someone discusses a problem with you, your first and most natural tendency is to give advice. It's been well said that the propensity to give advice is universal. But don't worry, because the propensity to ignore advice is also universal. People very seldom take your advice, no matter how good or well-intentioned it is. Often people don't want advice at all. They merely want an opportunity to talk out the problem with someone they trust before going and resolving it themselves. If you are going to offer advice, you need to be sure that three conditions are present. First, you should be confident that your advice is correct. Just because it worked for you doesn't mean that the same course of action will work for someone else. Second, you need to be sure that the person seeking your advice is truly ready to accept it. Sometimes a person will seemingly ask your advice when they are fully intending to do something else anyway. Third, when offering advice, you should be certain that the other person won't blame you if the advice doesn't work out. You must make it clear that although you may be offering suggestions, the choice and responsibility of following them are up to the other person. You have the ability to be a much better communicator than you are right now. There is no talent that will help you more to achieve the happiness, success, and satisfaction you desire from life than that of being excellent in all your communications with others. Although we communicate, we speak and listen all the time, it's an error to think that you are already good enough at it, because there are 100 things that you can learn and practice that will improve the quality of your communications and the quality of your life. It's really important for you to say what you mean and then to listen carefully to the response of the other person. Your intrapersonal communication, your relationship with yourself, is the key determinant of your relationships with other people. The more you like and respect yourself, the more positive your self-image, the more easily, openly, and honestly you'll express yourself to others. The more thoughtful you are about your communications and the more attention you pay to being a good communicator and especially a good listener, the more effective you are in all your relationships. Most of our problems in life are the result of poor social skills, miscommunication, and misunderstandings in our work and in our personal lives, and they can be overcome with practice. Here is an action exercise for you. Select one person, the most important person in your life, and practice being a good listener with that person. Train yourself to be aware of not only the words, but the feelings behind the words. See if you can develop a deeper understanding of how and why the person feels the way they do. In addition, begin observing the conversations of others. Train yourself to observe the quality or lack of quality of communications in the interactions around you. Notice the problems and misunderstandings that arise when people do not take the time to communicate clearly or listen attentively. Above all, begin actively working on your own ability to communicate with your spouse, your children, your boss, your co-workers, and your friends. See what a difference this will make in your relationships and the overall quality of everything you do. have a choice. You can either be good at influencing and persuading others to go along with you, or you can simply be influenced and persuaded by others to go along with them. Winners and high achievers are those who have learned how to be good at getting the active support and cooperation of others in a variety of circumstances. In this session, we're going to talk about some of the things that you can do to be far more persuasive in your personal and your work life. The basic fact is that people do things for their own reasons, not for yours. The art of persuasion is to get people to want to do what you're asking them to do. This is the key to diplomacy, the key to effectiveness as a boss, and the key to being a good parent. If you take some time to study people and learn how they think and respond, you can dramatically increase the likelihood that they'll be persuaded by you to do what you want them to do. There's been a tremendous amount of research done on various personality styles and different ways of thinking and responding. Over the years, researchers into human behavior have determined that there are two scales of behavior that divide personalities into four basic types. The first scale of behavior is introvert versus extrovert. An introverted or indirect person is a person who is quiet and inward-thinking in his or her interactions and behavior. An extrovert is a person who is expressive and outgoing with his or her thoughts and feelings. The second scale is the scale from people orientation to task orientation. A person who is people-oriented thinks of people as the central focus of his or her life and activities. A person who is task-oriented is more concerned with getting the job done than he is with the impact that his behavior will have on the people who are affected. When you combine these two grids, you get the four basic styles: the relator or amiable personality, the analytical or the thinker personality, the driver or the director personality, and the expressive or the socializer personality. The amiable personality is a person who is introverted or indirect in his or her manner of expression, and who is at the same time intensely people-oriented. These people tend to be very concerned with feelings. They are sensitive, and their primary motivation is to get along well with others. If you're trying to sell an idea to an amiable, you would point out how your idea would positively benefit or affect the relationships among people, how it would enable people to be happier, to feel better, and to get along better together. Amiables, or relators as they are called, place a high value on teamwork and acceptance. For example, if you were selling a house to an amiable, you would point out how beautifully the house is designed for socializing. You would suggest that the family would be able to get together in this room and that the children would play happily with this layout and that your friends and relatives, when they visit, would be impressed and approving of the design and structure of the new home. But you would be low pressure and low key. The amiable makes decisions slowly and only after plenty of thought. The amiable is attracted toward fields such as the helping professions, teachers, nurses, psychologists, guidance counselors, and social workers, where they can spend most of their time talking to and relating personally with others on a one-to-one basis. The second type of personality is the thinker or the analytic. This person is indirect and task-oriented. The thinker personality is most concerned with details. The thinker is neither people-oriented nor extroverted, but takes great pride in doing things well and is very fastidious about accuracy and neatness. When you speak or deal with a thinker, he or she will always ask you a lot of penetrating and detail-oriented questions. The best way to persuade this type of person is to answer these questions fully and with exact facts and figures. For example, if you were selling to a thinker or analytical personality, he or she would ask a lot of questions about technical specifications, performance specifications, price, terms, and small details. With this type of person, you should focus on being low-keyed and very accurate with your facts. The thinker or analytical personality style is mostly found in the professions of accounting, bookkeeping, engineering, administration, computer programming, and other fields that require careful attention to detail. The third personality style is the driver or director style. The driver is both extroverted and intensely task-oriented. This person is most concerned with results, with getting the job done efficiently, effectively, and at the lowest possible cost. The driver has a low level and sometimes no level of concern for the people involved. When you're trying to influence and persuade a driver personality, you should concentrate your arguments on the results that he or she is trying to get. This person tends to be impatient with details and wants to get to the bottom line as quickly as possible. Instead of building an elaborate case with lots of facts, figures, and specifications, you need to get right to the point with the director or driver style. That's what these people are comfortable with, and they're capable of making quick decisions if what you're presenting makes sense to them from a result-oriented point of view. You'll find drivers in fields where clear direction is necessary. They will be successful entrepreneurs, supervisors, fire chiefs, salespeople, and coaches, as well as athletes. Their determination to get results, to succeed, often makes them come across as aggressive and unfeeling toward others. The fourth type of personality is the expressive or socializer personality. This type is both extroverted and people-oriented. The socializer tends to sparkle with energy and personality. He or she talks rapidly and uses emotion and gestures to communicate and to interact with other people. The expressive or socializer type of personality is very achievement-oriented. He's very interested in himself and his accomplishments. In order to persuade the socializer expressive type of personality, concentrate on his or her achievements and show this person how he or she can accomplish even more and gain even greater recognition and praise by following your recommendations. The most persuasive person is the one who can use all four styles, the one who has the ability to be flexible in dealing with different personalities. The natural tendency of the poor communicator is to insist upon treating everybody the way he or she thinks and acts. The excellent communicator takes some time to get a feeling for how the other person responds and what his or her motivations and interests are before beginning any attempt to persuade and influence. You will find that this personality flexibility is fairly easy to develop if you simply slow down in your communications and watch and listen to the other person intently. Good communicators are always good listeners. They develop a sensitivity to the other person, which enables them to be far more effective in getting the other person to cooperate with them. The power of suggestion is another important factor when you're trying to influence or persuade a person in a particular direction. The basic rule is that everything counts. Everything that you do or neglect to do has an impact on whether or not the person will cooperate with you. Remember, first impressions are lasting. You never get a second chance to make a good first impression. Basically, people make a judgment about you within the first 4 seconds of meeting you for the first time. Within 30 seconds, their judgment or opinion of you has been largely set in concrete. In no time at all, they have pigeonholed or filed you away in a particular category, and it's very difficult for a person to change his or her mind about you once it's been made up. Once you've come to a conclusion about a person or situation, your natural tendency is to look for information to reinforce your conclusion and to simultaneously ignore information that contradicts your conclusion. For these reasons, it's very important that you think carefully about the first impressions you make, especially in terms of your dress, your accessories, your posture, your grooming, your body language, and your tone of voice and attitude. Everything counts. If you're going to be making an important presentation to a customer or to someone else, or if you're going to an important interview, you'll be more effective if you use the mental programming techniques that we've spoken about earlier in this course. The most powerful of all is mental rehearsal, the act of closing your eyes and visualizing yourself in the interview situation. See yourself as calm, confident, relaxed, and in complete control. Visualize the other person or persons responding to you positively and constructively. Create the exact emotion that would accompany a successful interview or sales presentation. Get the feeling that goes with the picture of success. Once you have this mental picture and you have emotionalized it, you can relax and drop the entire process into your subconscious mind. There's been a good deal of research done in recent years into the factors that influence people to behave as they do. it's useful for you to be aware of some of these influencing factors so that you can be more effective in guiding, controlling, and directing other people's behavior in your favor and on your behalf. Dr. Robert Cialdini of Arizona State University has identified several influence factors, or what he calls triggers, that often cause people to respond immediately in a favorable way, even when they had no interest at all in the subject just a few minutes before. These influence factors are used all the time in modern persuasion, in sales and marketing, in negotiating, and in relationships with our family and friends. When you know them, you can both use them on your own behalf and also recognize when they're being used on you. According to Cialdini, the most powerful of all influence factors in persuasion is reciprocity and obligation. We're structured psychologically so that whenever anyone does anything for us, we feel obligated to reciprocate and to do something back for the other person. Whenever someone does us a favor, we feel like we owe him or her one in return. Whenever someone makes a concession to us on any matter, we feel obligated to make a concession in return. This factor of reciprocity is so powerful that by using it consciously, you can turn a person around 180 degrees, sometimes in seconds. There are three main forms of reciprocity. The first is psychological reciprocity. This means that if you give a person credit for his or her intelligence, he or she must give you credit for your intelligence. If you compliment a person on his or her accomplishments, his or her business, his or her office, the other person will feel obligated to give you credit for your intelligence, especially if you're making a recommendation for a purchase or for a decision that's in your favor. Always be looking for ways to trigger this power of psychological reciprocity. Abraham Lincoln said, "Everybody likes a compliment." What he may well have sensed was that sincere compliments often trigger the desire to reciprocate by cooperating with you and helping you to achieve your goals and objectives. The second type of reciprocity is emotional reciprocity. If you do something to make another person feel good about himself or herself, the other person will feel obligated to do something to make you feel good about yourself. When you do a favor or a kindness for someone, you trigger this factor of emotional reciprocity. When you send a thank you card or a gift, whenever you go out of your way to do something that is kind or generous for another, you trigger emotional reciprocity. The positive give and take of most relationships is based on the unspoken but accepted principle of reciprocity. The third type of reciprocity is material reciprocity. Whenever you do something material or financially for another person, you trigger within him or her a desire to reciprocate to the same or to an even greater extent. If you pay for lunch this week, you trigger the obligation to pay for lunch next week. If you help a person financially by saving or gaining the money in some way, the person will feel consciously and unconsciously obligated to repay you in some similar fashion. The principle of reciprocity is so powerful that it underlies almost all personal and business relationships in the United States. Our entire society is based on the law of contract, which is a formalized method of reciprocity. All successful business people, salespeople, and politicians continually use the principle of reciprocity to trigger within the minds and hearts of other people the desire to help them. The second influence factor that Cialdini identified is called commitment and consistency. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds." But what this means is that we all try to remain consistent with what we have said or done in the past. We buy the same foods, we go to the same restaurants, we drive the same cars, we follow the same routes to work and home, we shop at the same stores, and we make other decisions in the same way. Whenever you can show a person that what you are asking him or her to do is consistent with what he or she has done or said in the past, you exert a powerful persuasive influence on that person's behavior. When you're making a sales presentation, for example, if you show the prospect that what you are selling is consistent with what he has said that he needs or wants or has bought in the past, it becomes very hard for him to resist your offer. The other part of commitment and consistency is what I call the law of incremental commitment. This says that when you first approach people with a new idea, because they've never done it before, they have very little commitment to doing it now. However, people tend to act themselves into commitment. If they will take a small action at first, they will tend to take even greater actions in the future. Commitment and consistency is also triggered when you persist and finally get a face-to-face meeting with a client. When the prospective client or customer has invested time in meeting you, giving you information, and learning a little bit about your offerings, he or she starts down the slippery slope of incremental commitment toward becoming a full-fledged, bona fide customer for your products or services. But always, we act ourselves into commitment little by little. Then, we strive to remain consistent with what we have done in the recent past. You can often influence a person to go along with your suggestion by simply pointing out that what you're asking is quite consistent with what he or she has already said or done. The third form of persuasion or way of influencing other people is called social proof. One of the first things that a person thinks or says when presented with a new idea is, "Who else has done it?" What the research shows is that we are inordinately influenced to act by learning that someone else similar to ourselves has already done it. We tend to assume that if someone else in our industry or someone else like us in some other way has already done it, then it must be all right. We assume that the other person, being as intelligent and as discriminating as we are, has already carefully evaluated the pros and cons of the offer before making a yes decision. Another influence factor is what is called liking. Human beings are predominantly emotional in all of their thinking and acting. When a person genuinely likes another person, he or she tends to be far more receptive to whatever that other person is asking or offering. Emotions distort valuations. We tend to downplay the weaknesses in the offering and to emphasize the positive factors, especially when we like the person who is making the offering to us or asking us to do something. Liking is one of the most powerful of all factors in persuasion. All successful salespeople, all successful negotiators, all successful politicians and business people tend to be warm, friendly, and genuinely likable human beings. There's probably nothing that will cause you to be more effective in influencing and persuading others than to work on your own personality, to build your own self-esteem and self-acceptance, and then to convey your inner feelings of self-liking outward toward the liking and accepting of other people. There are three other keys to persuasion, and they all come from the Greek language. They are contained in the words ethos, pathos, and logos. Ethos stands for your character or credibility or personality, your ethics. The very first thing you need to establish in any situation where you hope to influence another person or persons is your credibility, the fact that the other person can trust you and believe in what you are saying. Whenever a speaker is introduced at a public talk, the introduction contains information on the speaker that builds up his reputation and credibility in the minds of the audience. The introduction tells the audience what that person has achieved and accomplished that makes it worthwhile for him or her to be speaking to this group. Often, when a speaker begins, he will expand on his credentials and explain something that he has accomplished that is impressive to the audience and which opens the minds of the audience to listening to him. In a professional sales or interview situation, the first thing that you must establish is the ethos, your credibility as a person worthy of consideration. You can accomplish this by giving some brief background information on yourself or your company. If you wish to sell an idea, for example, you would give some information on how you had researched this idea and where you had acquired the information upon which your conclusions are based. This builds up your credibility and opens up the listener's mind to what you're about to say. The more believable you are, the more likely you are to be effective in persuasion. The second part of persuasion is pathos. This means connecting with the deep subconscious needs of your listeners. Because people are primarily emotional, it's when you speak to their emotional needs that they're most likely to be influenced and persuaded by you. You must think through in advance what needs your offering can satisfy. It may be the need for prestige, or for financial gain, or for security, or for beauty, or for health, or for respect, or for self-esteem, or even for personal and professional growth and development. Good persuaders are those who structure their arguments in such a way that they tap into the key needs of their audience. Addressing the right need triggers a desire in the person to take action to get whatever it is that you're suggesting. The third part of persuasion is logos. Logos is the logic or why a person should accept your recommendation. The reasoning part of your argument always comes after the ethos and the pathos, the establishment of your credibility, and you're addressing the key need or needs of your listeners. People use logic, reason, and arguments to confirm a decision they've already made based on their emotions and their needs. Successful salespeople and successful presenters always remember to keep the three, ethos, pathos, and logos, in their proper order in presentation, speech, or argument. The best way to influence and persuade others is to put yourself in the other person's position and look at your idea or offering through the other person's eyes. Why would this person want to cooperate with you? What are your best arguments that you can marshal to persuade this person to accept your idea or recommendation? What is it that this person wants or needs that you can satisfy with your offering? What's in it for him or her? How will he or she benefit? Remember, people only do things for their reasons, not yours. Power is an important factor in influencing and persuading others to do anything. Take your time and get all the information you need before you launch. Be patient. Speak to other people. Investigate every source of information that you can find to help your case and reinforce your argument. The power is always on the side of the person with the best information and the most accurate notes. In addition to careful preparation, another important element of persuasion is timing. The Bible says, "There is a time for every purpose under heaven. There is a too soon and a too late in all of human affairs. And there is a right time and a wrong time to present your argument or to try to persuade someone to your point of view." Picking your time and place carefully can be the most important thing you do in achieving success. When you telephone a person or when you meet with them, it's always advisable to ask, "Is this a good time to talk?" If a person is rushed or upset or angry or distressed for any reason, it's much better for you to delay the conversation and come back at another time that's more appropriate. Excellent communicators are very sensitive to the psychological and emotional dynamics of a conversation, and they're alert to whether or not the timing is right for what they're trying to accomplish. If you're trying to get a person to change or to do or accept something that he or she has never done before, remember that there's tremendous resistance to anything new in the minds of almost everyone. Very few people can accept or adjust to a new idea or a new way of doing things the first time it's presented. Most people will respond with resistance, negativity, and just plain no. They're in a comfort zone and they want to stay there. People will even resist positive and beneficial change rather than to move out of their comfort zones. However, you can reduce the resistance to new ideas by taking time to make the other person aware of the problems that exist, and then by showing him or her that adopting your idea can help to alleviate those problems. Present your idea in the form of a solution with very definite, measurable benefit to the other person. Expect resistance, and just be patient. Since some people are motivated by desire and others are motivated by fear, point out the hazards and costs of not accepting your idea. Show how the person can benefit by going ahead and how he or she will lose or potentially suffer a loss of some kind by not changing, not buying the product or service, or not doing what you are suggesting. The art of persuading and influencing is this. People need time to adapt and adjust to new information and new ideas. It takes about 72 hours for a person to internalize or accept a new idea and begin to see the advantages and benefits of it. In a small pamphlet given to me by a wise man many years ago called "Take Time Out for Mental Digestion," the writer recommended that you present your ideas in a low-key, non-aggressive way, and then, knowing that you will get resistance if the idea is new, just leave the idea with the person to think about for 2 or 3 days. To be a good influencer and persuader, you must learn and practice everything that's been learned by the very best salespeople, negotiators, and business people over the years. You must review these ideas and methods, especially prior to going into an influencing or persuading situation. If you keep your eye on the ball, keep your mind on the goal that you are trying to achieve with the discussion, and refuse to get distracted by side issues or emotions of any kind, you can become very effective at getting people to help you achieve the kind of success that you desire. The fourth influence factor that Cialdini has identified is that of authority. We tend to be strongly influenced by people and publications that we respect as being authorities in their field. For example, the magazine Consumer Reports is a powerful authority that determines probably hundreds of millions of dollars worth of purchases every year. It is seen to be an objective magazine that gives timely and accurate information on the relative merits of a great number of products. Many people won't even buy a product before they've read about it in Consumer Reports. If, on the other hand, Consumer Reports gives a bad rating to a product or service, that alone can cause that product to go into a tailspin in the market. In every community, there are business and social leaders who are highly respected by other members of the community. If one of these business or social leaders buys your product or service, that information is often sufficient to cause many other individuals or companies to do the same thing. For example, Citicorp Banking is one of the most respected and innovative banking corporations in the United States. When Apple Computer came out with their Macintosh model, they wanted to get the computer into businesses alongside and, in some cases, replacing the PCs that businesses were already using. But rather than spending a fortune on advertising, they instead went to Citicorp and offered them 1,000 Macintosh computers on spec. The company could take the computers and use them for 2 or 3 months and then decide whether or not to keep them or send them back. Citicorp, being open to new ideas and new technology, dispersed the Macintosh computers throughout its many offices. Eventually, people began playing with the Macintosh computers and the mouse, which makes it so easy to use. In time, more and more employees, programmers, and executives found themselves using the Macintosh because it was so user-friendly. At the end of 2 or 3 months, Citicorp decided to keep them. Apple Corporation then turned around to corporate America and said, "Look, Citicorp has already purchased 1,000 of our new Macintosh computers." The rest is history. In less than 5 years, Macintosh sold more than 1 million units and made Apple Computers one of the most successful and profitable computer companies in the world. The authority of Citicorp as a major purchaser was more valuable than all the millions of dollars worth of advertising and publicity that Apple could have purchased in a competitive marketplace. The final influence factor that causes people to act quickly rather than to take their time is scarcity. What researchers have found is that when something appears to be scarce or hard to get, it becomes far more attractive in the eye of the prospective purchaser. When we were in high school, we didn't even know that we were interested in a member of the opposite sex until that person began playing hard to get. Suddenly, that person became far more interesting and attractive than they were before. There's an old saying in selling, "No urgency, no sale." Whenever an item is scarce, that is, there are few of the items or there are very few of the items left at this low, low price, it becomes more attractive in the mind and heart of the prospective purchaser. A very common technique in selling is what is called the takeaway close. In this close, the salesperson, confronted with a buyer who cannot make up his or her mind, suddenly says, "Just a minute, before we go on, let me check and see if we still have the size and color that you're looking for." The individual then goes off to the telephone or rushes off to the storeroom to check to make sure that they still have one in the size, color, or shape that you want. Very often, an indecisive buyer suddenly decides that he or she wants the item very badly when the possibility develops that she might not be able to get it at all. This technique is used very commonly in ladies' boutiques, in automobile sales, and even in the purchase of large, expensive homes. Whenever you can suggest or imply that if a person does not act quickly, there may be no chance to get it at all, you can often trigger a decision. The fact is that scarcity implies value. Something that is scarce is considered to be far more desirable, and therefore the decision is far more urgent than if the item is in ample supply and there's no pressure to make a decision. Here's an example that illustrates five of these influence factors in action all at the same time. You're out walking through the supermarket on a Saturday afternoon, and someone stops you and offers you a free sample of cheese or a particular food. Without thinking, you accept the free sample and eat it. Instantly, the law of reciprocity is triggered, and you feel obligated to pay back the person for the free sample by buying a full container of the product, even though a few moments before you were completely uninterested. Having eaten a little bit of the product, the principle of consistency is triggered. Having enjoyed a sample, purchasing a full container is consistent with your initial enjoyment, and having taken the first act, you have begun incrementally acting yourself into commitment to a full purchase. If there are other people around who are also tasting the free samples and buying the full packages, the factor of social proof kicks in. If other people like you are shopping in the same store and they're enjoying the samples and purchasing the product, then it must be all right for you to do the same. If the salesperson is pleasant and friendly and thanks you courteously for taking the free sample, the influence factor of liking kicks in. You feel like buying it because you feel positively toward the salesperson. In addition, if there's information that suggests that this is an exciting new product that's been approved by the store or by Better Homes and Gardens, or it has the Good Housekeeping seal of approval, you are influenced by the authority that seems to suggest that this is an improved item to purchase. In virtually all advertising and in all effective sales appeals, including the behavior of successful salespeople, these various influence factors are brought to bear to induce the other person to move from negative or neutral to positive and to the acceptance of the offering of the product or service. Now, here's an action exercise for you. What do you need to do to be more effective at persuading others to cooperate with you? Write down a list of the people and the situations where it would be helpful to have the cooperation of others. Specify a clear goal for each influence and persuasion situation. What do you want to accomplish? What would be the ideal outcome if you were completely successful in getting your way? Now, think through what is in it for the other person. What can you do to establish your ethos, your credibility, to present your idea so that it satisfies the deep subconscious needs of the other person, and what arguments and logic can you marshal to support your argument? How can you prove or demonstrate to the other person that he or she will get the benefit that you're suggesting? Remember, people will only do things for their reasons, not yours. As a good influencer, you can get almost anything you want in life if you will simply present your ideas and desires in the form of benefits and advantages to the other person. Instead of thinking about what you want, reverse the process and think about what the other person wants and how you can help him or her to get it. You can use these persuasion principles with your children, your spouse, your boss, your customers, and the people you buy from. You can get more of what you want faster by learning how to use these persuasion techniques and by practicing these ideas at every opportunity than you ever could otherwise. Try them and see for yourself.